Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guests today are Lydia Wilkes and Nate Kruder, the editors with Ryan Scannell of Rhetoric and Guns. Guns hold a complex place in American culture. Over 30,000 Americans die each year from gun violence, and guns are intimately connected to issues of public health, as is evident whenever a mass shooting occurs. But guns also play an important role in many Americans' lives that is not reducible to violence and death, as tools, sporting equipment, and identity markers. They are also central to debates about constitutional rights, as seen in ongoing discussions about the Second Amendment, and they are a continuous source of legislative concern, as apparent in annual ratings of gun-supporting legislators. Even as guns are wrapped up with other crucial areas of concern, they are also fundamentally a rhetorical concern. Guns and gun violence occupy a unique rhetorical space in the United States, one characterized by silent majorities like most gun owners, vocal minorities like the firearm industry and gun lobby, and a stalemate that fails to stem the flood of the death. How Americans talk, deliberate, and fight about guns is vital to how guns are marketed, used, and regulated. A better understanding of the rhetoric of guns and gun violence can help Americans make better arguments about them in the world. However, where guns are concerned, rhetorical studies is not terribly different from American culture more generally. Guns are ever-present and exercise powerful effects, but they are commonly talked about in oblique, unsystematic ways. Rhetoric in Guns advances more direct, systematic engagement in the field and beyond by analyzing rhetoric about guns, guns in rhetoric, and guns as rhetoric, particularly as they relate to specific instances of guns in culture. The authors attempt to understand rhetoric's relationship to guns by analyzing rhetoric about guns and how they function in and as rhetoric related to specific instances in media coverage, political speech, marketing, and advertising. Original chapters from scholars in rhetorical studies, communication, education, and related fields elucidate how rhetoric is used to maintain and challenge the deadly status quo of gun violence in the United States and extend rhetoricians' sustained interest in the field's relationship to violence, brutality, and atrocity. Lydia Wilkes is assistant professor of English at Auburn University. She studies intersections of rhetoric, violence, and writing in public discursive and material spaces. As a gun-owning hunter, she supports firearms regulations as a matter of public health and safety. Nate Kruder is associate professor of English and director of first-year writing at the University of Georgia. He has written a variety of articles on rhetoric in the U.S. intelligence community and the rhetorical canon of style. He is a gun-owning hunter and fisherman who believes that the rights afforded by the Second Amendment and sensible firearms regulation can be balanced. Lydia Wilkes and Nate Kruder, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Tom.
So before we jump into the substance of the book, I think we need to take a moment just to note that even in the context of this culture, we seem to have reached perhaps new lows of violence with the shootings that took place in Buffalo, Philadelphia, and Uvalde, Texas. And I also want to note that tomorrow, students at Michigan high schools, where I'm located, are marching in protest, instigated primarily by the shooting that happened at Oxford down the street from us here at Oakland. So on one level, this question seems almost painfully self-evident, but what brings you both to the study of guns and rhetoric? Lydia?
I got started on this project after the Newtown shooting because as a hunter and as a gun owner, I noticed a big gap in the way that rhetoricians were talking about guns. And I thought that we had something to bring to the table that I had not really seen in the research literature to date. So I wanted to make this opportunity available. And luckily, Nate and Ryan jumped on board, as did some fantastic authors. And we have a book here where we're trying to explicate some of the stalemate that is definitional at this point of rhetoric and guns in the U.S., where we continue to have these mass shootings. And there's continued outcry for common sense, as some of the phrasing is used now, legislation that would prevent some of these atrocities. And yet nothing happens because the gun lobby is a very powerful force. So I wanted to get this project going because I thought rhetoricians had something to say. And I'm grateful that so many people did have something to say and contributed to this volume.
Nate, can I ask you same
sure.
question?
I got into this accidentally. I used to be a regular columnist for Inside Higher Ed. And after the Newtown shootings, I wrote a column reflecting on that and reflecting on some legislation that was pending in North Carolina at the time that would allow students to college students to bring guns with proper permitting into the classrooms. And that that column got picked up by very engaged pro-gun advocates and became quite a source of stress in my life for a while as I received threats. I had people suggesting that I should harm myself. And it was a really, I'm really proud of the column, but it was a really bad experience kind of taking that pressure from that particular constituency. And so I really didn't pursue it after that. And then in 2018, I was at the Rhetoric Society of America conference, and Lydia had already envisioned this project. She already had a CFP written, and she was looking for folks to work with. And a mutual friend, colleague, scholar, Patricia Roberts Miller, connected us and said, you know, you two might want to work together on this. And so I saw Lydia's vision, which she just articulated. I saw the CFP that she had written, and I said, yeah, this is I'm not sure this is going to be fun, but it seems really necessary. And Lydia's really on to something here. And so that's when I got on board for this particular project.
So I guess, you know, that last thing you said that, you know, this project is not particularly fun. I mean, I get, you know, you said both of you, I think, to some degree speak to this, is that you kind of get drawn into this topic rather than choose it. It's almost as if it chooses you. I don't know if that's the correct way of saying this, but I get that sense that people who get drawn to this kind of work are pulled in more than they choose it.
Yes, I completely agree with that. That's been my experience too. In fact, I when I was preparing the CFP, I struggled for a little while because I thought, you know, is this something I really want to do? And I just felt like I had to do it. I felt compelled to do it because I thought that I was positioned appropriately to try to gather some folks together and present something that might contribute to the conversation. But you know, it's strange to have a volume out that on the one hand I'm very proud of, but on the other hand I wish didn't have to exist. So I've been grappling with that quite a bit lately.
I think that's what I mean. I think you phrased that beautifully because, you know, again, there's a lot to be proud of in this volume. It's erudite. It's interesting. It's obviously engaged in an important issue. But my God, I wish we didn't have to talk about this.
Yes. But at the same time, you know, every time I find myself in that headspace, I remember, you know, I'm not suffering the trauma of the families. I'm not suffering any of the effects of direct violence. So at the same time, I pull back on that and I say, well, let's not whine about this too much, because really it's a difficult headspace, but things are so much worse out there for so many other folks. So that's how I tend to kind of pull myself out of it and say, let's just keep going and let's keep trying to make a difference on this issue.
And Nate, do you have a similar sense?
Yeah, very, very much so. You know, I really, when we finished this volume, I kind of said, this is great. I'm proud of it. I'm gonna move on to other things. And with Uvalde, I've been reflecting a lot this week. I feel that I actually have to do a lot more on this topic right now. And so I think I'm going to be re-engaging a lot more. And it's not the thing I would choose to do, but I feel really called to do it. And I feel called actually as a gun owner, not as a rhetorician. I think lots of rhetoricians could write clearly. We have lots of great contributions in this volume, but unfortunately, I think that one of the strategies that people use to prevent reform is to try to discredit people who are not gun owners when these debates are taking place. And so I think it's incumbent upon people who understand guns, who have grown up around them, to propagate the arguments for sensible regulation. And so I feel, as somebody who can speak the language of firearms, who understands them, who has lived a primarily rural life for most of his life, I feel it's my responsibility in that capacity to use my rhetorical expertise to try and tip the needle. And I know a lot of people are doing a lot of great work, but I happen to be a rhetorician, so this is where I'll contribute my work. But I really feel, as somebody who's grown up around guns, who understands how they work, who understands the language around them, the identity issues. I think you mentioned identity in your opening, and I think that's the key issue I'm thinking more and more. So I'm re-engaging, but reluctantly.
And yeah. To echo what Nate said, I also felt responsible as a gun owner primarily, and as a rhetorician secondarily, to speak to this issue. And for the same reasons that Nate said, that gun owners get maligned, but gun owners really need to be leading this issue. And yet we're not, largely. We let the NRA talk for us, even though we don't actually exist in the NRA's category as gun owners who oppose their stance. I also want to echo what Nate said about the Uvalde shooting pulling me back into this topic as well. I was working on some different work this summer and found myself in the past couple days diving back into this topic, and already have an article in the works. Again, something I wish I didn't have to write, but I really think that there is a lot more to be said here, and that gun owners and rhetoricians are well positioned to say it.
I agree. And so let's use that as a jumping off point for my next question. Now, this is going to sound obvious probably to the three of us, because we all have a background in rhetoric. But let's investigate what I take is the central premise of this collection. And it may not be obvious to many of our readers, but how do you see guns as rhetorical? And let me start with you, Lydia.
You know, there are so many ways that this question can be answered, because guns can be seen in a discursive sense as rhetorical. They can be seen in a material sense as rhetorical. And the book takes up both of those. I think I'm just going to pass this one off to Nate, because I think Nate has a better answer than I do.
Okay.
Well, so I'll start building on that. Yeah. Guns are rhetorical in the material sense, right? And that they perform, I hesitate to say this, but it's true, they perform political work, right? Acts of violence are not always political, but they are. And I would say that even, you know, something like this Uvalde shooting, where we don't know the motive, we don't, you know, it's not a terrorist organization saying we want this, but it's a political act nonetheless. And as issues of identity get tied to guns, and in particular to the AR-15, which seems to be the particular weapon where identity for a particular gun group is coalescing, these are where we have expertise, right? We understand how symbols function as rhetoricians. And so we have a particularly weighted problematic symbol in that unlike another problematic, say the Confederate flag problematic symbol, this one can cause physical harm, right? So we know that the messages sent by the Confederate flag can cause certain people a certain type of harm, but I don't think that's comparable to, you know, a bullet. And so we have this thing that functions in these two ways simultaneously, and as a field, we haven't really applied our expertise to that. And so in some ways, this book is as far as rhetorical theory goes, I don't think that, you know, we're breaking like really new ground in terms of what rhetoricians have to say and deploy in terms of their own theory. What's new is we're deploying it against this particular artifact, both as a physical artifact and as Lydia says, as something discursive. And so we're turning that rhetorical gaze, our discipline's expertise on this object much more systematically and symbol, much more systematically than had been done previously. But for me, that word identity is really where this is starting to coalesce. The arguments against regulation seem to be breaking more and more, focusing more and more around issues of identity. And so to me, that's becoming the linchpin for why resolution on this topic seems not possible right now, and where we'll need to work if some sort of legislative compromise is going to be brokered.
Although it's in, and this is, you, and you, maybe you can speak to this experience. I am not a gun owner. I am not someone who has grown up around guns. So I had my first opportunity to fire a gun just a couple of months ago, as a part of my son's involvement with the Boy Scouts, and we went to a shooting club where these very nice gentlemen were explaining to all of us, you know, the fathers got involved too, you know, how to fire a weapon and safety and the whole nine yards. And then at one point said that they asked us for money to pay for the ammunition that we were using for target practice. And they said, we used to get this funded through the NRA, but they stopped giving us money for this purpose. And it seemed to me that, you know, you mentioned the NRA a minute ago, that the NRA, what my son was going through in this instruction was probably what the NRA should be doing, but then apparently is now no longer doing.
Yeah, that's what the NRA used to do. You know, the NRA of my grandfather's generation was a really different NRA than the one that we have today. It was to promote firearm safety, to promote firearm skills, and something like a 22 and the safety issues around that is very, very different than something like an AR-15. And so I do see that as the older mission of the NRA. A sort of related topic is that as a gun owner, it can be very difficult to create separation between yourself and the NRA, because the NRA is the primary insurer of shooting ranges. And so many shooting ranges will require membership or some sort of you might be able to purchase like a one-day membership type of thing. But this makes it very difficult for gun owners who are not comfortable with the advocacy that they engage in to find places to shoot that they're not supporting that organization. And I should be clear, I don't think the NRA is kind of like the actually even the key to the problem anymore. I think that they're just really easy to talk about because we know their contributions to the problem. But I think even if the NRA were to suddenly, you know, say they lost some massive lawsuit and evaporated tomorrow, the issue that would not solve any of the issues that we're facing, unfortunately, I don't think. But these are fraught. You know, how do you be, if you are a gun owner, how do you be a responsible one without also contributing to this one organization that's driving the debate in the wrong direction? It's really tough.
And to pick up on what Nate said there, definitely this is the older function of the NRA when its purpose was to help help men acquire better marksmanship skills. But there's also a good deal of research on the NRA's formation that shows that one of the ways it was formed was around slave catching. So to go back to the issues of identity, it's true that they've marketed themselves initially in this seemingly non-political or apolitical way, but in fact we can find the present issues we have with identity as they've cohered around white masculinity, particularly Southern white masculinity. We can find that back to the origins of the NRA, and there are several great volumes on this that are referenced in the collection a bit. But I did want to note that that behind that seemingly normal veneer of firearm safety, there is also identity always being constituted.
Oh, sure. Just the intersection with the Boy Scouts too is kind of interesting. So before I put you both in sort of the unenviable position of discussing some of the many excellent contributions to this volume, let's talk about your own essays in this book. Nate, yours comes earlier in the work, so let's talk a little bit about rhetorical velocity.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do in this essay is use velocity, literal velocity, as a way of understanding how firearms are functioning in the public sphere. And velocity has been a big thing of interest for the gun industry in my lifetime, in the sense of, as I argue in the essay, guns are constrained. You can only fit so much powder into a shell. You can only put so large of a bullet into the shell. And so in order to improve performance, what modern firearms manufacturers have focused on is increasing the velocity, the trajectory with which the bullet leaves the firearm. And this is true, especially for weapons like the AR-15, which are defined as high velocity weapons. And so I try to extend this idea of velocity, which Jim Ridolfo and his co-author have previously talked about, although not in relation to firearms. And I try to ask, are there other, if we think of velocity as a property of physics, are there other properties like mass that might explain the situation that we're in? And I think I come to the really uncomfortable conclusion that certain events have more, and now I am being figurative, have more mass than other events. And so, for example, Newtown has a lot of rhetorical mass because children and violence towards children, while we are traumatized by all violence, I think the trauma of such young, innocent people, it is weightier rhetorically, culturally, than other types of violence towards adults. And so that's why these certain propaganda machines have to snap into action, because the mass is such that people affected by this are actually in a position to get some change initiated. And this is why you see groups like Alex Jones trying to discredit the Newtown parents. I'm sure we will see similar efforts with Uvalde. But, I'll even put it this way. You mentioned the three recent shootings and the one in Buffalo, as horrific as the Buffalo one was, and it was horrific and it was racially motivated, and we know all of this, it's already out there, I'm sure more details will emerge. That event doesn't have the same mass culturally. It's not being talked about at length in our media in the same way that the Uvalde one was. And so why is that? Is it because the Uvalde event had more victims, 19 as opposed to 10? Is it because the Uvalde victims were younger? They're primarily elementary school instead of a variety of ages, as we're in that supermarket. And you come to the really uncomfortable conclusion, I think, that we don't weigh violence against all people the same in our culture. And so I think we are getting to this inflection point of how young and how sort of suburban, maybe suburban white, do victims need to be before we will take action? I think, you know, while we haven't seen any tangible action yet, the rhetoric of the need for reform is so much greater surrounding the Uvalde event than the Buffalo event that we have to dig into that. And so rhetorical mass, as I articulate it in this chapter, is a way to kind of understand that difference and understand how it's functioning rhetorically within not necessarily one person's conception of things, but in our sort of collective response.
And Lydia, your contribution comes a little bit later. So let's talk a little bit about what you frame as the rhetorics of acquiescence and resistance.
Yes. And I end up building on Nate's idea of rhetorical mass as well, which I've been thinking about quite a bit lately in connection to Uvalde. So I argue that rather than assent or dissent to the presence of guns, to overwhelming gun violence being the sort of definitional of the debate about guns, it's really characterized by acquiescence or by a sense of giving in to the prevalence of gun violence, as though it's kind of too big of a thing for us to confront, or it requires too much time, too much energy. And this relates back to Nate's chapter on mass, because he talks about the fact that the NRA, for example, is extremely well organized and has a massive membership, and that helps them combine the mass of their membership with the speed and efficiency of their organization to create this incredible force, this rhetorical force that they exert on not only the gun debate, but on all of these laws that mostly don't get enacted because, as we will see again, the package of modest reforms that the House has passed is going to fail in the Senate because the gun lobby is exceptionally well organized. And I agree with Nate that we're at a moment, it would seem, where the side for gun safety, as gun control has been recently reframed, is gaining mass. There is certainly a lot of attention focused on this issue. I'm always, anytime there's attention focused on a mass shooting, as there was after Buffalo, I'm always watching for how quickly it's going to dissipate, because typically it dissipates quickly. And it did in that case. But with Uvalde, we're still talking about it a good deal later. And that gives me some degree of hope. However, I don't think the legislation will pass. Instead, I think the opportunities to accrue mass here come with gun owners. And particularly, I thought Matthew McConaughey's speech at the White House, where he appeals to responsible gun ownership, has a good deal of potential. But what needs to happen there to accrue sufficient mass is that he or somebody else needs to be willing to take more of a political stance than he's willing to take on that issue. And so even though I think he could be a really ideal figurehead to lead a movement, it seems like he's a little reluctant to do that. So on the one hand, I am cheered by what's going on, by the fact that we're still talking about it, because acquiescence in part is fed by the fact that we have a very limited attention span as a culture. We tend to move from one thing to the next, like a hummingbird. And the fact that we're still talking about this is a good thing, but I am not holding my breath for action yet. I think that the protest you talked about, Tom, at Michigan, in Michigan high schools, I think that the young people have the ball is clearly in their court. They are aware that this is an existential threat to them. And the more that they are willing to sustain their organization over time, the better. I really hope that there are a lot of high school students who are going to be spending their summers organizing for mass walkouts in the fall, because I think that will grab attention and that will sustain attention. And that has the capacity to move the needle on this topic.
I hope you're right, but I think we probably should. And again, now I'm going to put you in kind of a tough spot because I'm asking you to talk a little bit about some of the other contributions, and you have one that specifically discusses the Parkland movement and the idea of never again. So should we move on to that?
Sure. In fact, that one is informing my research right now. That's Brad Serber's piece on the last mass shooting and the notion that Parkland will never happen again, and how this is ultimately not very effective or helpful frame, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so we get wrapped up in this. And again, you know, again, I agree with you that it's going to be the, you know, the children shall lead, I suppose, is the way to put it. But at the same time, you know, after the shooting here in Oxford, which again, you know, one of my speech students had a brother who was one of the victims. And my son, you know, driving him home from school, and we passed not far from there, you know, basically confronted me with the questions like, well, you know, what are you doing about this?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, like kids can do so much, but at some point, you know, they still look to the adults in their lives and say, you know, what are you doing?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that troubles me a bit is that one things we adults are doing is talking about the wrong solutions, like arming teachers, but also talking, kind of relying on capitalism to solve this problem. So, for example, in my chapter, I talk about the Wonder Hoodie, which is a form of, you know, not actually that protective, but it's a form of body armor that people can purchase that comes in, you know, will fit a 6-year-old. And so we're at a point where we're more willing to use capitalism to try and solve problems with technology than we are to push a public debate on this and to push politicians to be accountable to what the people want.
So in the introduction, you talk about the idea of stasis theory, and I'd like to ask either one of you, I guess we can start with Nate, how are you using the idea of stasis theory, and how do you think that gun rhetorics can be framed by it?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because that's exactly where my probably next phase of work will go. And I think I was probably the person most interested in making sure that got into the introduction. I think that those who want to stymie reform and regulation are brilliant manipulators of stasis. And what I mean by that is it's generally understood, if I can be forgiven perhaps an oversimplification, but it's generally understood that if we are arguing different points, we're not going to come to resolution. And stasis theory gives us a way of diagnosing and understanding, are people arguing about the same thing? And those that oppose regulation are happy with the status quo, because the status quo means that they can continue to purchase the firearms they want in the ways that they want with the lack of oversight that they want. So they don't have to get anything done. They just have to prevent things from getting done. And so when reform comes up, they're really skilled both as individuals in conversation and as lobbyists and more organized advocacy groups at shifting stasis, right? So as soon as you start to talk about banning assault weapons, which is a policy argument, they'll begin to argue over the definition of what constitutes an assault weapon. And so as soon as you then address the, you know, what is an assault weapon, what isn't, what is it that you're referring, then they're talking about a different value, which is the sort of abstracted values that they see in the Second Amendment. And this just in perpetuity. And so all they do is destabilize the debate. But that means that we're never actually following an argument, whether it's, you know, two people talking or whether it's a legislative body deliberating. We're never following an argument through to its end. And so I think that this sort of stasis whack-a-mole, you could call it, that these groups play is just maddeningly effective at preserving the status quo. And so I think we're going to need strategies for how to pin people in a stasis so that we can proceed through it to where we might make some collective decisions about policy. So I think that this is really where I'll be focusing my future work. And I think it's where we really need to understand the skill with which both individuals and groups have done this. And I should say, I think that Those who are against regulation do a really good job of sort of disseminating how to argue to people who are sympathetic towards them. So this becomes a sort of like it's top down, but it goes so thoroughly through that community that it sounds and feels grassroots. And so even if somebody is not versed in, you know, how to lobby and how to argue, simply being in the presence of these arguments a lot makes them really skilled at shifting stasis when an individual confronts them with counterarguments. And that's certainly been both my experience as an individual and my observation as a scholar.
Lydia, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think that Nate's covered that really well.
Okay. Again, there are a lot of you've got some really wonderful essays in this volume. Are there any in particular that you want to raise in the context of what we've been talking about so far?
Yeah,
I suppose we should go ahead.
Well, Nate, since you brought up identity, I think it's worth talking about Patricia Roberts Miller's essay, which leads the volume, where she argues that what tends to happen in the gun debate is that we will start out arguing policy, and the NRA in particular will shift this to identity, to the issue of identity. So they'll make it about a good guy with a gun rather than about red flag laws. And she argues that you cannot debate policy in this way because you're not actually debating policy, you're debating identity. And she sees this within the structure, the framework of demagoguery, where it's reduced to both sides or to two sides and to us versus them and in-groups and out-groups fighting against each other for a sense of moral superiority. And this gets us nowhere. So I think this is a really important opening chapter because she gives us a way to understand the fact that the NRA, for example, doesn't admit the category that she's in, where she is both a gun owner by virtue of common law and someone who opposes the NRA's stances. So I think that's a really brilliant chapter that starts the book off because it shows us how, I wouldn't say this is a shift of stasis necessarily, but it shows us how the conversation is repeatedly shifted to different terms that get us away from policy argumentation. And hence, things don't get resolved. We remain deadlocked because we're just talking about identity. So I think that's one that that I think about a lot and that I use in my work. And so I definitely think I wanted to start there.
Good. So I guess I have maybe that's a question that I can ask you both. So as I said before, I am not a gun owner. I did not grow up around guns. and this is kind of interesting in regards to one of the contributions. I grew up in Detroit. And my father bought a shotgun. probably shouldn't tell this story. After the 1967 riots in the city, and kept it for the next 30 years as kind of a completely embarrassing symbol for himself. He didn't actually get rid of it until much, much later. But having said that, I have known a good many gun owners, hunters and people who collect, and have found all of them to be sort of that, you know, I'm assuming like you guys, you know, the responsible gun owner, right? Like everyone that I know who owns guns, I think is a good person, and I'm sort of completely comfortable with them owning guns. So how, if that's the majority, and I believe that it is, are we in this sort of position where a minority is leading the discourse?
I have a couple answers, and I'm going to try and answer first by rehabilitating your father for you in my answer. So let's consider, you know, what prompted that. I imagine that those events, whatever, you know, we know what was causing them, but whatever was causing them and however well or not well understood that was at the time, it must have been really scary. And so guns provide, at times, they do provide control. You know, if you are in control of your firearm, you can shoot an animal at 300 yards if you're skilled. But in that sort of situation, I think what a gun provides is an illusion of control. And so I imagine that perhaps a person who had experienced that was feeling helpless. And in our culture, with those things available, that was probably an attempt to kind of feel in control of his safety, of his family's safety. And so that's not a difficult impulse to understand, right? And I think particularly in our culture, because guns are so much more present in our culture than in many other Western cultures, it sort of makes sense that a person would gravitate towards that as an attempt to feel control. So you come into today and we're in a period of climate instability, as one of our chapters touches on. We're obviously in a period of political instability. I would say we're in a period of racial instability. And there is a constituency that sees guns, I would say, much more vociferously than perhaps the reluctance with which your father might have purchased that shotgun. But they see guns as their insurance against, and I mean that quite literally, they see them as their insurance against all of the instabilities that they see around them. And that's why they're so adamant, right? They genuinely believe in many cases that the gun is going to be the last thing that kind of prevents them to falling into the morass of chaos that they think they see around them. And so...
And not without good reason.
Yeah, we do have political instability. We do have racial problems. We do have all these social effects from economic disparity and racial tension. Like those things that they see are real. I think what's an illusion is that guns would solve any of those problems for them. I'll even put it, this may be a little too dark, but you know, I know both types of gun owners. I know a lot that I think are responsible, and I know some that frankly scare me. And of the ones that scare me, they tend to be the hoarder type almost, right? Like they don't just need a gun. They need a lot of guns and they need a lot of ammunition. And futilely, sometimes I'll try to argue with these folks who are in some cases, friends, some cases, acquaintances, and they'll try to advocate like why I should be doing the same thing. And my point to them is like, There's no reason to have 5,000 rounds of ammunition, because if you need 5,000 rounds of ammunition, you're going to die anyway, right? Like there's no situation where you need 5,000 rounds of ammunition and you're actually going to be able to shoot your way out of it. And even if you can, what's your quality of life going to be? So I think that this is really a fantasy of control, a fantasy of being able to defend themselves against the instabilities we see, which are only going to be solved collectively, only going to be solved by groups of people cooperating, not by individuals taking, you know, a courageous stand against whatever they perceive to be those threats.
Yeah, Ira Allen's essay in your volume speaks to this issue.
Very much so, yes. Yeah.
And it's interesting because it kind of balances on those two extremes where obviously he's not advocating for hoarding and he's talking about a shotgun and he actually frames it as a non-defensive weapon, because you know, as you just said, if we're in a situation where you need that much ammunition, you know, what are you really defending at that point? And then also for some of us, you know, there's kind of an apocalyptic sense to all of that as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I think for a lot of the most extreme, a very strong and a very explicit apocalyptic sense, you know, look at the quote-unquote prepper movement that is come forth in the past 10 or 15 years. And similarly, I think, I think that there's, so I was hesitating whether I wanted to actually say this or not. I mean, you have to bring in, as some of our chapters do, the evangelical movement, right? Which I think there is a vein of theology that's prominent in the evangelical moment that sees bad things as good because these are indications of the rapture. And so I think that there, I certainly couldn't paint all opponents of gun reform as being in this category, but there are a lot of them who have a theological kind of faith that all these bad things are actually a sign that it's going to break down and that religious resolution is getting really close. And so I think we don't talk enough about how religion and guns are becoming linked as identity markers for some Americans.
Yeah, that I think that's absolutely true. I guess the one last point, and I is in regards to Alan's piece that I just want to throw this out. One of the subtexts that runs throughout this entire book, and even I think the discussion that we're having right now, is the way that guns are racialized. Right, that you know, as you mentioned a minute ago, Nate. You know, we're talking about Uvalde. We're not talking about Buffalo. And while at one level, you know, that could be because of numbers, and it can be because of age, I think we can't also escape the fact that it's because of the color of the skin of the victims in Buffalo. There's another subtext, though, that I noticed, especially in Alan's piece, which is that for some folks, you know, and again, this is that, as you said, the quote unquote prepper movement and that sort of those apocalyptic rhetorics. Like I have type 1 diabetes, right? And so if the apocalypse happens, I ain't going to be able to shoot my way out of anything. If we come to a situation where I have to start hunting squirrels for food, my guess is that I'm not going to be able to acquire the insulin that I need to live in order to eat that squirrel. And so for a lot of us, you know, we're sort of devoted to a collective response to whatever exigencies we face, and an individualized one just ain't going to fly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that is an interesting shift right now in dynamics of gun ownership, and I think this speaks back to the looming sense of apocalypse that even if you're not in an evangelical community, I think is somewhat pervasive among just the general population. And what's happened since 2020 is that there are a lot of new gun owners who don't fall into the white male category that gets discussed prominently in the book as a category of race and gender. I think especially of Lisa Corrigan's chapter on this, where she explicates the gun as securing whiteness as property. But what's happened is that white women and people of color have started buying guns in significant numbers since 2020. There's a shift in gun ownership happening right now. And a future project for me will be to go to the gun ranges and find some people to interview. And I think that what I'm going to find is some version of what Nate already said, which is that guns offer this illusion of security. And I think that that's what white women and people of color are starting to purchase now, which the NRA loves. They've been trying to get white women on board for at least two decades, and pink accents on guns really didn't do it. But you know, maybe these doomsday preppers constitute enough of a threat for women, white women and people of color to think that, well, maybe I should arm myself too. And anytime I talk with people about this, I get a person of color or a white woman or a woman of color who says to me, hey, I just bought a gun for the first time and now I'm going to the range. And so I'm really concerned for these folks because everything in our book says that they're putting themselves at risk, because if they're going to be carrying at all, especially any open carry, only some bodies are permitted to carry firearms in this country, and other bodies are not permitted to carry firearms and are at risk if they do so, as we saw with the endless litany of deaths of Black people, including Black children. So, like, I think of Tamir Rice in particular. And so so I'm really worried about this, but at the same time, it sort of shows that what Nate was saying about purchasing a fantasy of security. And I think what Ira's talking about in his chapter with this apocalyptic doom shrouding us, I'm worried that people are buying more and more into the individual fantasy of security, and less, or I'm not seeing the evidence that people are buying into collective action into solidarity, coalition, and mass movements, because I agree this is not something that can be solved individually.
And again, right, as you said earlier, buying the gun is the capitalist solution, right? It's like if I want to feel safe, then I go buy something, whether it's the armored hoodie or even the gun. Again, it's interesting. The semester that I had the student whose brother was one of the victims at Oxford, that the round of speeches where he couldn't come in to do his persuasive speech, right? It was like, you're probably familiar with this idea. And during that very round, a young woman got up and gave a speech on gun ownership as a feminist issue, advocating that, she owned a gun because she was a feminist.
And there's something to be said for that, because domestic violence is a significant category that overwhelmingly affects women. But I would want to hear more of that argument to hear how it is. What kind of feminism is it being ensconced in?
I'm not sure that she was distinguishing between types of feminism.
Jonathan Rauch, 20 years ago in Salon.com, advocated something similar for the gay community. And he tried to found an organization called Pink Pistols. And what his argument was that gay folks are subject to abuse, to real violence, and they should arm themselves and be very vocal in doing so and very visible in doing so. And I used to use that article a lot with classes, because what I found is it created a chiasmus between how much are your pro-gay rights or anti-gay rights and your pro-gun versus anti-gun, how much are those in tension? So do your pro-gun sentiments outweigh your anti-gay sentiments, or do your anti-gun sentiments outweigh your, belief that this community should be able to protect itself? I don't use it anymore, because students find, at least my students find gay rights so uncontroversial, so it doesn't create that tension anymore. But there have been movements trying to argue for. Marginalized groups, vulnerable groups, to arm themselves and to do so visibly. But I share Lydia's fear that does that just make it easier then for other people to then victimize these groups?
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, since we're living through, again, this, this heightened moment, about national media coverage of, we should also point out, right, we're focusing a lot, as inevitably you do, on these mass shooting events. But of those 30,000 deaths per year, the mass shootings are a relatively small fraction, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about about national news coverage. You have a chapter devoted to this as well.
Yeah, you want to go ahead, Lydia?
Sure, Lydia.
I didn't get to reread that chapter, so I don't have it fresh in my mind. And what I have to say about national media coverage is mostly a lot of angry emojis.
Yeah. The author takes it up as the way that the national news coverage sort of buries the idea of white supremacy.
Yeah, I'll take that up. So I think. So I agree. I find the argument of that chapter compelling, but I also don't know what we expect of the media, right? So like right now, people are saying, well, maybe it's like Emmett Till, and the media needs to show this stuff. What a fraught position to be in as a media person, right? Do we traumatize the public? Do we provide bait to that really small percentage of people who would get a rise out of seeing something so graphic? I don't know how the media is supposed to play this. And even like with the Buffalo example, we were just talking about it getting knocked out of the news. Well, what did it get knocked out by? It got knocked out by Uvalde, right? So like, is that the media paying less attention to racial violence in that case, which it clearly was, or is it just, you know, that we've reached the level of absurdity where we don't even have time to give that incident its due diligence and due investigation before the next more tragic thing happens. I acknowledge that I think we do obscure nationally the role of race in these issues, but I also don't know, you know, what are we supposed to do? Not cover Uvalde? I don't know how the media kind of balances these issues, and I think it's a really unenviable position that they're in as well.
Yeah, and I think too that I mean, given the consolidation of media outlets into corporations, there isn't much motive there to try to call out white supremacy or to do anything that might upset an already, you know, tumultuous state with regard to race relations in the U.S. So I think it's understandable why they would do that. I don't think it's excusable, but I do think that that there are reasons for that. And it, for me, largely has to go, but goes back to the profit motive for corporate media, which I know puts folks who study journalism and do journalism in an extremely difficult place, in addition to the difficult place that Nate already described.
Yeah. So let's maybe talk about, and these are sort of, I think, two related themes, the campus carry movement and then the chapter on the activism gap. I've done another one, another interview on folks who studied campus carry legislation. I know it's becoming increasingly prevalent around the country. Nate, apparently you got sort of wrapped up in it. So do we want to talk about it?
Sure. Yeah. And I think we should point out that Kendall Gurdy's chapter is about that campus carry, academic freedom and rhetorical sensitivity. Yeah. As I said early in the interview, that's how I, that's how my gun ownership and my scholarly interests intersected to where I talked about this for the first time. You know, as a gun owner, I clearly believe that people should be able to own guns. That's non-controversial to me. I am particularly scared of young folks in the particular environment of a campus carrying weapons, even though I understand that these laws require them to be permitted and these sorts of things. First of all, permitting doesn't mean much. It means that people take perhaps a half day safety course. It doesn't guarantee that they're a skilled or even terribly responsible owner and user of that gun. And so the permitting process doesn't give me confidence that somebody would be really trustworthy with that weapon. And then, you know, just having taught college now for almost 18 years, I just see that and increasingly over those 18 years, our students are really stressed out. And so what happens when guns are present in that environment? You mentioned, you know, that mass shootings are not the majority of gun violence. Suicide is really prevalent in terms of the numbers of gun deaths that we have in this country. So what happens when really stressed out students have a firearm, you know, in their living quarters, on their person, in a building, you know, where they have access to it at a moment of acute stress, or their roommate maybe can access their weapon in a moment of acute stress. And I think that college students are really at the peak of sort of life stress combining with their, you know, not quite fully developed adult minds, right? Like, we know empirically that the human mind is not done developing at age 18. And so what happens when you put in all of these grade stressors and these away from home stressors and these financial stressors, because so many of our students are financially stressed and social stressors and, you know, experimentation with substances for the first time. And this is the population that we're sort of trying to
Arm.
Yeah. That's the only way to put it, right? Like, it just doesn't make sense from any perspective, unless your objective is to propagate a particular view of guns and perhaps to make the people teaching those students feel a little defensive. There are instances of people, you know, the quote unquote good guy with a gun preventing tragedy. But if you talk to campus police, they're terrified of this scenario. How will we differentiate between the active shooter and the good Samaritan student, right? They won't. They'll shoot them all.
Right.
And so campus police are terrified by this prospect. They generally oppose it. And I'll say also, as somebody who's worked with veterans a lot and was a former intelligence analyst where we had a shooting range in the building, it takes a hell of a lot of training and hell of a lot of skill to be able to use a firearm effectively in a stressful situation. And so, you know, the idea that a good guy with a gun, whether they're a college student or in another context, is going to be able to save the day, I'm not saying it never happens, but I'm saying the vast majority of the time it doesn't, because people freeze. People act recklessly, where maybe they would injure somebody else rather than the culprit in that situation. And so I just see it as I see it more as an act of legislative intimidation than a genuine effort to help students to keep themselves safe.
Yes, certainly. Campus Carry has been promulgated primarily by Turning Point USA as a overtly political act. And they are the organization that tends to spearhead campus carry from one state to the next. And then going back to Nate's point about campus police not being able to distinguish between an active shooter and a good Samaritan, there was at least one instance of a shooting at a community college in Oregon some years ago where a student was armed and decided not to intervene because he knew that there was no way for the police to distinguish him from the perpetrator. So even in that situation, that person, who I think was being a very responsible gun owner, made the choice to not intervene because he recognized the danger there. So I wanted to just point out that this is a strongly politically motivated thing, and also that just to underscore Nate's point about the incredible difficulty that this poses for a vulnerable population that's in transition and also for law enforcement personnel.
Yeah. So as we wrap up today, I think we've probably already talked about this, but I'll just give you a little short opportunity here to let us know what you're working on next. Nate?
Yeah, so I've got a couple irons in the fire, not related to this, but as relates to guns, I'm going to be pursuing this issue of stasis and how organized lobbying groups, how they intentionally shift stasis in public policy debate. So that's really going to be the focus for me. I'm also interested in the identity issue. I do think unless we can address the identity concerns that lead people to own, you know, 20 AR-15s, for example. Unless we can address those identity concerns, I don't see much prospect for progress here. And I'm not sure what that means to address those identity concerns yet. All I know is that, and there's some really recent work that's come out in the popular press about... there was a guy in the Washington Post just recently, former gun industry guy, Ryan Buss or Bussy, it's B-U-S-S-E. And he's really talking about how guns are an identity marker and that this is the reason that people are so reluctant to give them up. And I think he's spot on. And so, you know, how do we address that when somebody sees a gun as an identity marker in the same way that we might see our religion or we might see our ethnicity or our cultural heritage? It makes it seem to me that those people might not be open to persuasion. And so then if people aren't open to persuasion, how do we proceed?
Yeah, Ryan Bussey has which I think is how you say his name, has a book out too. Yeah, about his sort of industry insider. It's not a tell-all, but it sort of goes in that direction.
Oh,
and it's the
I heard an interview with him.
Yeah, it's the I can't recall there has been a precedent, but I can't recall one for someone speaking out in this way. So I like to see that. And in terms of the work I'm working on right now, I'm building on some work that Craig Reed has done. He has a piece that was published in 2018 called Our Tears Are Not Enough. That's about the warrant of the dead. And that just says that since they died, we should do X, where X can be anything. And he argues in that piece that the warrant of the dead is not a very effective way of motivating political action. So I'm picking up on that. And the piece I'm working on right now is called Our Deaths Are Not Enough. Because we're at a point where, you know, people say, well, how many more children have to die? And the answer is that there's not a number, because if the deaths of young people were going to motivate political action, that would have already happened. Sandy Hook was the moment for that. And while this is a similar moment, it doesn't have, I think, the same level of urgency and shock. And so what I'm arguing is that the warrant of the dead is, it gets used, but I think it's completely ineffective to motivate rhetorical action. And instead, I'm picking up on Nate's discussion of rhetorical mass and rhetorical force, and looking at mass movements and how people have protested these issues in the past. I am particularly sort of cheered by the example of Standing Rock, where they held out a very long protest, and the fact that private security was turned on them shows that they were ruffling some feathers. So I think that mass action is one of the solutions going forward, and that's what I'm going to be working on next.
Well, we'll look forward to it. Lydia Wilkes and Nate Kruder, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Sure. Once again, my guests today have been Lydia Wilkes and Nate Kruder, the editors with Ryan Scannell of Rhetoric and Guns from Utah State University Press. My name is Tom DeSena, and you are listening to the New Books Network.